Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 155 with the title, Healthcare with a Heart. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Susie Green. Susie is the co-founder and co-director of Ann Health, dedicated to providing compassionate, accessible healthcare for trans people of all ages. And when I asked Susie to describe her superpower, she said that it is empowering trans kids and their families with care, resilience, and love. Hello, Susie. Welcome to the show.
Lovely to be here, and good morning.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this. We chatted, I think, on LinkedIn probably 6 months ago, and then we met at the Trans in the City Awards night back in November on Trans Day of Remembrance, or no, Trans Day of Week of Visibility, wasn't it? Yeah. And yeah, I've been a huge fan of the work you've done. I've come across you and your organisations in over the years, so it's a real honour. So you've been at the forefront, as I probably just implied, of trans healthcare and supporting people for years. So what first inspired you to do this?
Well, it was having a trans kid, and before I knew I had a trans kid, I knew nothing about trans rights, trans kids, trans people in general. I was, you know, completely oblivious and knew nothing. But when my daughter told me that God had made a mistake and she should have been a girl at 4 years old, I had to learn, and I had to learn quickly because I needed to be there to support her. And as her biggest advocate, I needed to learn what I could do and what was out there. And I knew nothing, absolutely nothing. I knew of the existence of trans people, obviously, but I suppose just hadn't really thought about the fact that trans adults were trans kids. You know, they had to have been trans kids. So having a trans kid was a bit of a wake-up call for me, and it took a lot of digging and searching and trying to find out what I could do to best support her, including, you know, going to the GP. I found the website of Mermaids online and phoned the helpline number when Jackie was six, because by this point, I'd spent a lot of time telling her it was okay to be a boy and like girl things. And she just kept telling me that, no, she was a girl. That's 2 years of literally sort of ignoring what she was telling me and trying to reiterate a different reality to her, and she never wavered. So at six, I found the Mermaids website online and called them, and sort of that set in motion things that sort of have ended up with me here where I am now.
So just put some context in that. Your daughter is now in her 20s or thereabouts.
Early 30s.
So we're talking about a considerable amount, 25 years ago, give or take, here.
Yeah, a long time, yeah.
So you can't escape but notice the opinions and rhetoric in the world around trans people, trans children, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're going back to an era here of 2000-ish, 99, 2000, 2001, where it was pre-Equality Act 2010, pre-Gender Recognition Act 2004. People just, well, pre-Facebook, really. So how did you find people to support you? Because in those days, it was like the Wild West, I guess. There was no information.
I mean, I found a single paragraph in a book on raising boys that talked about girly boys and said that they were likely to be gay. That was it. And then when she asked me at four, you know, that's when I found that paragraph in the book saying that she would be gay. And I kind of was waiting for that narrative to switch, but she never stopped saying that this is who she was. So I think it was an Ask Jeeves search. So it was like literally.
So that's going back a bit. Ask Jeeves.
Isn't it? Ask Jeeves.
Yeah.
And I think I typed in something like, my son says they want to be a girl. And Mermaids was one of like three sites that came up. And the only one that I could actually get through to there was, I think the Beaumont Trust was another one. They had a phone number, but nobody was answering. And Mermaids was about three or four down. And I spoke to one of the founder members. I think Mermaids had been going for about 4 years by that point. And I spoke to one of the founder members and had a conversation. It was the first time I spoke to anybody who understood what it felt like, because the lady that I spoke to had a then 17-year-old trans daughter. The relief was immense. It was just enormous to know that somebody else was living through this and had some answers for me and some direction. I think I cried for like probably the majority of that conversation, because it was, I don't know, I suppose I was expecting a different outcome. I was afraid of verbalizing what I knew was happening, but I just got this huge outpouring of love and support. And I then joined there was a Yahoo group, online Yahoo group that I joined. I think there were about 30 people across the UK that were on that group. And I joined that group and started talking to other families, parents with kids. And I suppose that really was kind of it for the next sort of 4 to 5 years. excuse me. They told me about the Tavistock gender identity service, and I went back to my GP, who I'd spoken to when Jackie was four, and told me initially that God had made a mistake and she was really a girl. And I went to the GP, and she said, oh, he'll grow out of it. No signs of that happening still.
You'd hope not.
And,
30,
you'd
30
hope not,
yeah.
at 30-something. But yeah, so that was where I got the initial support. And that for like the first few years, I was just a member of that parents group, and wasn't really actively doing very much other than just seeking support and speaking to other families as I needed. Very strange. It's a long time ago.
I know. You said growing out of it. I suppose in my own life, I've grown into it rather than growing out of it. It's like, it's finding that comfy pair of slippers or that snuggly top and going, this is me, it fits. And
yeah,
there's no out, it's definitely in. So, you know, a lot of the rhetoric you hear today is around, if we educate our children to be about trans awareness and gender identity, all these genders, what that's going to do is it's going to persuade them it's a good idea and they should do it. Yeah. I'm obviously saying that tongue in cheek, you know. Yeah. That's the rhetoric that's prevalent in today's mainstream media and the world, isn't it?
And why would anybody choose this? It's really hard. Why would anybody choose this? It's an alien concept to me that you would, as a person, you would, especially now with all of the anti-trans narratives taking up so much space in media and everywhere. Why would you choose this? You just wouldn't. I speak to families day in, day out. I speak to young people day in, day out. And if this wasn't the only way that they could live, they wouldn't choose this, because it's hard. It's really hard. And it's getting harder, because the narrative is getting worse and worse, and people are being basically they're being made to feel ashamed of who they are, which is horrible and really disturbing. And as you know, as you say, it's simply a question of being able to live authentically. Everybody else gets to do that. Why shouldn't trans people have the same right? And why does it affect anybody else? It's nobody else's business.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I've noticed the kind of attack vector morph over the last few years into trans people are predators. Trans people are trying to, all the trans people are now trying to destroy the lives of young children and ruin their lives and mutilate their bodies with chemicals, dangerous chemicals and surgery and life-changing operations before they're even 10. Painting this picture of this big, chunky trans woman with a knife in one hand and a bottle of pills in the other, forcing it down a trans child's throat. That's what keeps, that's in people's heads, isn't it? We're scaring people into believing that this is some sort of bad thing to help, help young children.
I tell you, there's a picture that I saw on social media the other day, because I, you know, I'm obviously a lot of people's favorite person. And there's a picture of me, and it's like a cartoon image of me with a big grin with a big needle in my hand. It's just really, really stupid. You look at what's going on, the narratives that are being said. These people who are pushing these narratives, there are so many things in the world in terms of injustices and things that they could be concentrating on. Instead, they choose to persecute a vulnerable minority and make their lives so much harder than they need to be. And they're doing this with this almost overzealous rigor to basically stamp trans people out of existence. Yet there are so many things that do actually need that level of concentrated effort to address, including, you know, violence against women. And they're choosing to go after trans kids and trans women in particular instead. And it just, I don't know, it completely baffles me. I just can't understand it. Why on earth do they have such a focus on something that is never going to impact their own lives? And why do they think it's okay to go after kids and to make out that they should be ashamed of who they are and that their inherent being is wrong? I just find it really difficult to come to terms with that level of venom is being constantly addressed at children and trans women, as I say, in particular. Why do you look at climate change? You know, for goodness sake, we need some concentration on things like violence against women, against climate change, against, you know, corruption in politics and within the system. You know, we've got these very, very rich men at the center of, you know, billionaires, nearly trillionaires, obviously, who are basically manipulating the population. Why aren't they concentrating on what's being done to, you know, everyone who isn't in those positions and highlighting the injustices of all of those things rather than going after a vulnerable minority who are simply just trying to get on and live their lives? That's all. I've got lots of transgender people in my lives as well as my daughter, who I love very much. And that's all they want to do. They just want to get on and live.
Yeah,
leave them alone.
You look at the news, and you look at all these atrocities and terrible things that are going on, and none of them are trans people. We're talking about leading figures in churches and faith groups. We're talking about leading people in sports organisations. We're talking about leading people in communities, protecting each other in these groups of privilege who are kind of keeping silent and then say, well, but they're a nice person, really. They've just turned away to the dark side for a bit and we need to let them. You look at those things and none of these people are trans. None of these people are even pretending to be trans or using it as an excuse. And it's like, that's the frustration. We see cisgender women murdering children, babies. none of those people are trans. And I think that's the frustration that I, as a trans woman and many other trans people face, thinking, hang on a minute, there are other people out there doing what you're saying, but it's not anyone who's saying they're trans.
Yeah.
And that's so frustrating.
And the narrative has gained ground in like the general population's head. You know, they're listening and seeing this. And even though there is no evidence of what is being said, I remember a conversation that I had about 6 months ago with somebody where she went, oh, it's just gone too far now. She's like, you know, they're trying to take the word mother out of pregnancy materials. And I went, no, they're not. They're not. And she was like, what do you mean? I said, no, they're not. I said, they're adding in additional stuff so that it supports, you know, people who are not female, who have a uterus and who may want to have babies, but they will never see themselves as, you know, mother or mum because they're not. I said, so they're adding in. I said, they're not taking away. I said, it's just nonsense. And why would that be something? Why would anybody want to, you know, we don't get more rights at the detriment of others. It just means the world is more equal for everybody. I said, and she actually said, do you know, I feel embarrassed now because actually I've realized that I've been taken in by the rhetoric. How easy was that?
I know.
How easy was that for you to believe that headline? Yeah.
That's the lead. Taking the word mother out, destroying thousands of years of language. But the target is still trans women. Yeah, it's me that's causing this. And I go, hang on a minute. I'm a woman. I'm trans woman. I don't want to take the word mother out. I've got no interest in degendering language. It's not. I'm gendered.
Yeah.
What we're using is the non-binary people who want to get this recognition. And suddenly it's a trans woman problem as being part of trying to destroy society. And it's like, hang on a minute. Or what about trans masculine people?
Yeah, exactly. This was not the intention. It was about being more inclusive, not less. And this fake outrage.
I know. I get blamed for gender neutral toilets. It's like, I don't care about gender toilets. I mean, yes, they're nicer, they're easier, they're more convenient in shopping centres and car parks, things like this. Great, I'm happy with just a toilet, you know, something I can shut the door on. But I'm not banging on about this, that, and the other. And it's, again, these arguments are being conflated with sort of like gender outrage, trans women, and poor trans men are just going, let me grow my beard and get on with life. It's kind of thing.
Yeah. I know it's exhausting, and I can see why a lot of the community are so burnt out and are stepping back, and why people who are in the public eye, who are being attacked constantly, why they might feel, I don't know, not just tired of being blamed for something that, you know, is not their fault.
You've obviously been in the public eye for 15, 20 years, probably, I guess, quite a bit, especially through your role within Mermaids and what you're doing now, which we'll talk about in a minute. It's pretty brutal out there, isn't it? The attention, you get the negative attention, what people accuse you of.
Well, I mean, it's quite funny, really. I mean, I know the truth. You know, that's the thing for me. I speak to the young people, I speak to the families, I speak to, you know, as I say, so many people in my life now that I love are trans because of, obviously, the direction that my life has taken. But I know the truth. So I read this stuff and it actually just makes me laugh, really. The venom and the stuff that's aimed at me, it's quite funny. Because none of those things are true. I stopped a long time ago worrying about what other people's opinions who hold these opinions of me are, because I know what I'm doing and what, you know, my co-director, co-founder Lizzie is doing, and I know what our team is doing, and I know that the people that I've worked with over the years who you know, who have with alongside me, I, you know, being allies as well as members of the community. I know what we're doing is the right thing. And those negative conversations, they don't touch me. The things that they say about me, they don't bother me, because they're not true. And actually, as I say, quite comical, some of them. I love every now and again, something will come out. I think after exited Mermaids, there was a lot of jubilation about, oh my goodness, we've managed to get her. She's gone. And then when Anne Health launched, the reaction was hysterical. And it was like, oh my God, Susie Green. I think one of the ones that I screenshot and put sort of like on my screen, I wish she'd just shut up. But yeah, it's, yeah.
Yeah,
I don't really care what they say, but I know for other people, you know, it really hurts.
Yeah, I look at my web stats on a daily basis, and all of a sudden they'll jump through the roof, and it's all on my bio page or the home page or something. And I go, okay, so I look at the sources, and it'll be x.com or twitter.com, it'll be Mumsnet, it'll be some other site. Okay, so I hunt down the article to see what they're saying, and it's like, oh yeah, here we go. It's almost like playing hate bingo. Oh yeah, you said that. Dodgy wig, evil smile, staring eyes. We've got all, yeah, we tick, tick. Yeah, you've hit all the favorite food groups on that one. Thank you.
Yeah, we call them, Mumsnet is a Prosecco stormfront. It's like just this quagmire of entitled women discussing things and professing outrage. But, you know, not one of them is actually dealing or supporting a trans person in their lives at all. So they're just poking their nose into stuff that is none of their business.
Well, they all start off with AIBU. Am I being unreasonable? Yeah, actually, you probably are. If you don't mind. Actually.
Yeah, every now and again, if I want a bit of a giggle, I'll go put my name into Mumsnet and have a look at what the most recent stuff is. But hey-ho. Yeah,
I do it for a laugh sometimes, and sometimes screenshot it. When I'm doing keynotes and talks, what I sometimes do is post some of the latest, you know, most people put testimonials on there. So I just do negative testimonials. Clearly, this is what people think of me. I think I was equated to Joseph Mengele at one point, trying to destroy children. It's like, right.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's actually somebody did a mock-up of the child catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and put my face on it. That was funny. I mean, the best one, the one that like I hold most dear was when after Caroline Farrow and Posy Parker went after me and I spoke to the police potentially about a harassment case, which I then dropped because I thought I'm giving them like a platform with this. But somebody from America posted a picture of Ursula from The Little Mermaid up and said, this is Susie Green's true form. And I was doing the Mermaid's social media at the time, and I just replied and said, "But," and they said, she can't sue me because I'm in America. And I just went back with this picture, and I just replied and said, but seriously, does my bum look big in this? And then I screenshotted it and had it as my profile picture for years. I loved it so much. And, you know, people, friends, family, etc., still buy me Ursula products just because they think it's fun. So, but then, you know, she's the perfect baddie, isn't she? So,
well, she's got a bit of a cuteness about her as well. She's not completely evil, is she?
She's cool. She's cool.
Yeah, I think she's cool as well. I think, yeah, we'll. She's probably a fierce staunch of defense for us, for Ariel and things like that. I think she's there, really. She's looking after everybody. So, I think, yeah, we need. We need strong matriarchal characters in our pond, don't we, sometimes? Yeah, well,
yeah,
why not?
As I say, she was my profile picture for a lot of years.
Yeah.
So.
Glad you owned it, yeah. It is. I think anybody who's in the public eye, in whatever micro or macro way, you've just got to be used to people having an opinion on you. I remember Brené Brown knew she'd made an impact when she got more as much hate as she got likes on her YouTube. So think, and that's Brené Brown. So, you know, it's everybody gets hate. Marmite, isn't it? You love me or hate me. That's fine. I'm cool with it.
Yeah, it's, definitely.
But it's, where are we now? We're last couple of days of January 2025, and we're a few weeks on from events in the US where we're seeing a lot of EOs, executive orders coming out around trans people in military, defunding, you know, rejecting trans people in society, cancelling drive-in licenses. It's a real state in the States, and that travels across the Atlantic as well to us. We can't be immune to what's going on over there, can we?
No, and it's really disturbing to see what's going on. I think yesterday I spent in like a fog of disbelief about how bad it's got. Though, to be honest, kind of expected this to happen when, obviously, Trump got back in as president. You know, he started a lot of this when he was in his previous term and tried to move things in that direction. So these executive orders, although they're horrific, are not a massive surprise. And obviously there's work being done in the States to push back against them. But trans healthcare for trans youth particularly obviously has been affected by the executive order that came out, just over a day ago. And we're seeing within our organization, we're seeing families with trans kids in America reaching out and saying, can you help us? Because access to their healthcare for their kids looks like it's going to be shut down. And clinics are acting in advance of the order actually coming into law as well, and turning young people away from clinic appointments for blockers and stuff. So this is like, I can't imagine what it must feel like to be a family with a trans kid in America right now. I really can't. I don't want to think about it too much because it makes me feel so sad and really angry on their behalf about what they're being put through right now. It's awful. And obviously we've got our own issues here with Wes Streeting putting in the permanent ban against puberty blockers for young people on the flimsiest of premises. And Wes Streeting spoke to a room full of trans kids and their parents. And I've spoken to a parent who was in that space, and she said those 90 minutes were probably the most traumatic of her life because those kids shared what the blocker ban meant to them. And he said he heard them, and he looked them in the eyes and said he heard them. And then he went ahead and did it anyway. It's devastating. Politics has no place in healthcare, no place in healthcare. And this is going to, at some point, this is all going to be reversed. And this will be looked back as a particularly bleak and black stage of history for trans youth and trans people in general.
In the same way, we looked at what went on with AIDS, what we looked on with Section 28, what we looked on with racial discrimination, all the things we've looked back in our history and go, that's not a proud moment in time. And I agree. And it's, but where's responding really, I don't want to make excuses for him or anybody, from the Cash Report. You know, the Cash Report came out in the last dying embers of the Tory government, put it across the line. And on balance, it says some good things. There's some good things in the Cash Report. One is that we need better support for young trans people. We need to understand it better. So if you look at some of the positives, there's a lot of positives. Not one place did the Cash Report actually say puberty blockers were banned, because if they did, what would happen was that these trials they're proposing or embarking on, how can you embark on a trial for something you've declared as being a bad thing? So I'm hoping that the government do the trials, they take the heat out of this negative rhetoric and go, actually, here's logical clinical evidence now, which we never had. So, and I say, the end don't justify the means at all, but I'm hoping that we come out with something really credible at the end of this.
The only problem is the trial itself is completely unethical. To give, and you know, this was presented at the Women's Select Committee, as Simona Giordano, who's a bioethicist, you know, hit the nail on the head. It's completely unethical to force people into a clinical trial by withholding access to treatment by any other means. It is unethical and it breaches people's human rights, and actually lots of principles in terms of human rights are being trampled on by you know, this process. And what about the control group that they're saying needs to be there?
Yeah, the double blind. Yeah,
the double blind. So, yeah. That's not going to work. They're just, those kids are just going to, their puberty is going to continue on and they're just going to drop out of the studies. And the emotional impact on those young people, thinking that they've gone through all of this process, jumped through all of these hoops, then being accepted, and then their puberty progresses regardless, that emotional impact is going to have, that's a huge safeguarding risk. It's completely unethical. And it just highlights the fact that actually this medication can't be that bad if they're going to do a clinical trial on it. If it was as dangerous as they say it is, then they couldn't feasibly suggest that a clinical trial is a good idea. And the fact is that there's lots and lots and lots of evidence on how puberty blockers assist in gender-affirming healthcare. They just chose in the CAS report to disqualify all of those studies because it didn't fit their narrative. And we know that the CAS report is a political document because Kemi Badenoch stated as such that it was done deliberately, and trans people were not part of any of the team. So, and their reason for doing that, the reason that they said that they didn't have trans people, is because they didn't want, you know, it to be influenced. Now, if you did a review on diabetes care, would having somebody with diabetes mean that was, you know, biased? If you did a trial on autism, having members of, you know, of the group that were doing that review, you know, would having somebody who actually was autistic on that, would that be biased? No, it wouldn't. It's only trans people, and it's only trans kids and trans women who have been subjected to this sort of narrative. And, you know, it's been debunked. The CAS review has been debunked internationally, locally. There's so much evidence. Every day, more comes to light in terms of looking at the methodology, the conclusions that they've reached, the stuff that was said in there that has absolutely no basis in science or any research to back it up. That's just been popped in there as an opinion and has been taken as this holy grail of what trans healthcare for trans youth should be like. And it's a biased political document with an end game in sight, which has come to pass. And I was really hoping that Labour would have, you know, the foresight to look at this and go, this smells a little bit odd. You know, this isn't quite right. This doesn't seem to be, you know, led by the community. Nobody from the community was a part of this. Perhaps we should take this with a pinch of salt. And the fact that they're pushing the same narrative despite everything that's been said about it is a real concern.
Trans youth, though, is it? I mean, we look at adult trans support, the gender identity clinics, the waiting lists, they're now seeing people who were referred in 2018, 2019. If you join the waiting list now, you're looking at 6+ years, maybe even longer. For first appointment.
I don't even think it's 6+ years. I think it was extrapolated in that if you join the waiting list now, you'll be seen in 20 years because of the numbers that have been seen off the waiting list, that are coming off the waiting list, and the people that are being added. You're looking at 20 years.
You stand no chance.
No chance. No.
You've got to go private. That means you have to have privilege. You have to have the means and the wherewithal. Even private appointments aren't quick, because the limited availability of specialists in that area as well.
Yeah.
And it is horrendous. And I know many adults who are, you know, holding their heads in their hands going, what am I going to do? How am I going to handle this? There are very few places from a UK perspective that you can go for support these days for free. GPs don't want to touch you now. I've got lots of friends who have been deprescribed, if that's a word, from their GP, because it's like, oh, it's a bit risky. I'm not sure what I should do. Everyone seems to have a license now. Okay, all trans. This is a risky area. I've got justification now to be out of this and say I'm not comfortable. Yep. That's the impact of these studies and the rhetoric, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think the thing is that GPs routinely prescribe stuff that is like 1,000 times more toxic than HRT routinely to cisgender people day in, day out. Yet they're, you know, they're going, oh, this is a specialist area. It's not. It's really not. It's not. But
all the women I've spoken to about menopause support, it's clear that GPs are just not comfortable talking about estrogen, progesterone, prolactin, doing blood tests, finding out about people, let alone testosterone. So there's not a lot of, they always want to palm it off onto an endocrinologist, or they want someone to come and tell them that it's okay. Yeah. But people talk about these hormones as if they are powerful drugs. These are part of the natural body. Okay, they've been synthesized from cow urine or pig urine or bioidentical, whatever we're talking about. But they're not drugs as such. They're not chemicals that we're putting in our body. They're natural occurring hormones.
Yep. And using them to make people feel comfortable in their own bodies, why is that such a big deal? I heard the stories, obviously, not stories. I heard the reports of the GP surgeries who just took all of their trans patients off their books and went, we're not supporting you anymore. Blatant discrimination as evidenced by the fact that it's a just a complete, we are not dealing with trans people anymore. I hear it all the time. People telling us about their care being refused, that they've been on HRT for years, and the GP has always been like really supportive and not had an issue, and then suddenly an edict comes down from the practice, you know, manager or whatever, and they're changing the rules, and suddenly their access to hormones is removed. Thousands are being forced into self-medication, and for young people who don't have the means to access private care, and for adults who don't have the means to access private care, it means that they're starting using dangerous access means to be able to get what they need. It doesn't stop people being trans, and it doesn't stop people seeking to be able to feel more comfortable with the use of, you know, HRT hormones, etc. What it does is it forces people down routes that actually will harm them, and that's despicable.
There's a scene in the hit Netflix drama Orange Is the New Black, where Laverne Cox, trans character, I can't remember her character in the show, but Laverne Cox is suddenly denied HRT medication, which she goes up to the counter and they said, no, you can't have that anymore. And the panic set in her, I'm going to grow hair, I'm going to this, and no, if it's going to happen. It's like, and that was in a prison scenario where you've got no agency at all. So imagine what it's like if you're in America, in the judicial system, or even the military, or in this country, lacking privilege. That moment that you're thinking, hang on a minute, my life has been okay, it's been normal, I'm getting on with things. All that suddenly, it's gone.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no different to women finding that there's no more estrogen gel or patches on the market, and suddenly their menopause symptoms are going to come back with a vengeance. Panic was there then. It's exactly the same.
Yep. And we speak to people every day, who are in that position, who are suddenly finding themselves with this. I sympathize and empathize with them so much, because how must it feel to suddenly have something that made you feel yourself, made you feel comfortable with yourself, and enabled you to just get on with life and be suddenly taken away, and then, as you say, that panic, that feeling of, well, what am I going to do now? And that feeling that your body is going to betray you. Like, as you say, like menopausal treatment and care, it's to remove that like it is so irresponsible and dangerous. And the impact on people's lives is heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. The conversations that I have every day are heartbreaking.
So this is where your vision for Anne Health came from, isn't it? To create an organization that can enable people to safely access the support they need, not just medication, but support as well. It's not just handing out things. It's about talking to people and listening to people. So do you want to tell us a bit more about where the idea came from in your own words, and the problem it's solving, and how maybe some of the challenges you're having getting it going as well.
Yeah. I mean, and health sort of in terms of the idea, being part of Mermaids, being CEO of Mermaids, talking to families, young people, seeing what was happening in the UK with regards to access to healthcare for young people. I've seen thousands of families struggle with the NHS provision, but also access to private healthcare, because the only other provider is gender GP. So when I left Mermaids at the end of November 2022, I went to work for Gender GP. I knew Helen Webberly previously when she started providing healthcare for trans people and then started to extend that to young people. And I really respected who she was and what she did. And the amount of attacks and obviously the challenges that she faced and her husband faced because of that. So I went to work for Gender GP and sort of quickly realized that it wasn't for me, because what I saw, what I thought was within Gender GP didn't come to pass. And it was clear that they weren't providing personalized, appropriately medically overseeing care. So whilst I was in there, Lizzie, my co-founder, co-director, and I have known each other for years. And we started talking about there's got to be something better than this. There's got to be something that is actually as affordable as we can make it, whilst also ensuring that there is like the quality of care with the proper medical oversight. And we wanted to get it going, and we tried from like the middle of 2023, really up until the beginning of 2024. And we'd kind of given up about getting it started, because we needed seed money to get going. And we were so frustrated because we could see how much the community desperately needed an alternative, especially for trans youth who were only had, as I say, the NHS, which is broken, and even more so now, and obviously Gender GP. And we knew there needed to be an alternative, but we just didn't have the means to get it going. And then we had an amazing gift from a benefactor who said that they believed in what we were doing and that they wanted to help us. So they gave us like a chunk of cash to get going. So that's really how that started. So that was back in sort of March, April of last year. So we did a lot of stuff behind the scenes. We worked with some trial patients to make sure that our process was robust. We tried to get GMC doctors involved, and we had a couple of GMC registered doctors who were really, really keen, who really were supportive of the trans community, but they got warned off from working with a private healthcare company, particularly working with trans young people. So in the end, we replicated to a degree the model that Gender GP uses in terms of EU prescribers. But unlike Gender GP, everybody sees their doctor. So literally part of the process is that you see your doctor and you see them regularly, and they will talk you through your care and any questions, etc. So yeah, we got started at the beginning of 2024 with that amazing gift. Since then, it's gone from strength to strength. We came out as being, you know, to the public in July, just after the puberty blocker ban had been put into place. So we came out because we wanted people to know that there was an alternative, and that actually we were working towards providing a safe and legal route for people to be able to access puberty blockers, so that the criminalising of parents who just want to help their kids would that we would find a way to help them to do that legally. And yeah, it's interesting, I think, is probably the best word. It's interesting how much abuse is aimed at us. But again, like I said about me in general, and Lizzie's very robust, we don't care. We see the difference our services are making to trans people of all ages who need us, and we're gonna, you know, we're here for the duration. We believe in what we're doing. We also are a registered non-profit as well, so we do also provide some subsidized care and are looking to expand on that. And as we as an organization continue to grow, and as we have more surpluses, a not-for-profit that will go to subsidize people's care who can't afford it. So we wish we could provide free of charge care for everybody. It's not possible. It's, you know, we can't. But we will try and help people as much as we can.
Without wanting to tempt fate, touching wood, you haven't had anyone challenging you legally yet, have you?
No, but that's, we got some very, very, very good legal advice at the very beginning. So we worked with David Locke, who is, in terms of healthcare legislation legally, he's sort of top of the tree. So we commissioned him and his team to look at what we were doing, the model that we were doing, and to give us like their legal oversight into the best ways to ensure that we were as robust as possible. And I think that advice has, you know, been very timely, bearing in mind the blocker ban, et cetera, and also is a protective factor because we know what we need to do to ensure that we're falling within the letter of the law, that we're not encouraging people to do criminal activities. We are literally talking to people about the way that they can get the support that they need, and we're doing it in a way that is perfectly legitimately within the scope of the law.
Yeah, sometimes when I'm listening to people like Wes Streeting and other people talking about puberty blocker ban, I often wonder if they're aiming at gender GP primarily. It sounds like that. When they're not saying it explicitly, but they're kind of saying these offshore doctors based on the other side of the world, we want to stop them doing this, this, and this. And it's, I always think that sounds like gender GP rhetoric.
It so is. And unfortunately, the reports coming out of gender GP means that some of that concern is actually legitimate. In terms of, you know, Helen Weberley has stated clearly for the record and has done a Times interview where she talks openly about the fact that gender GP is run entirely on AI systems. So healthcare recommendations, except that it's all based on AI bots and an algorithm that she's put in for people, you know, so it's, your healthcare is not overseen by a real person.
It's a shame because gender GP helped me out 2014, 2015, in the early days when you were probably dealing with Helen yourself on these things.
Yeah. So they
certainly helped me they took me off of real self-med, which was, you know, internet drugs and those sort of things, internet hormones, and then at least got me into something that was a known source from a UK online pharmacy, and then the GIC took over with a shared care agreement with GPs. I was quite fortunate that I was probably before the problem started developing. So yeah,
I think AI bots don't have, I mean, they have their place in medicine for, you know, sort of like automating systems, etc. But for healthcare, for recommending healthcare, overseeing blood tests, etc., that's not their place. You know, we need real life people, and we run a helpline, so 9 to 5 Monday to Friday, and a web chat option so people can get in touch with us. And the actual relief that people feel when they speak to a real life person is immense. And we get it all the time. We have people calling up and going, oh my goodness, I didn't actually believe that I'd be able to get through to a real life person, that I'd be able to actually talk to somebody. And, you know, we offer that support from a helpline basis in terms of like general support, as well as obviously support in terms of the medical process and side of it. Now, one of the things that I experienced as a parent when I had to go through unconventional means to get my daughter medication, I had to take her, which is like ironic now, really, I had to take her to Boston in America to be seen by Dr. Norman Spack at the Boston Children's Hospital. And that feeling of being alone and being isolated and doing something that's going against what the NHS was telling me, because I was told that she had to go through a full male puberty to be sure that that's not what she wanted. And I was like, that's insane. That's insane. What you're saying that she has to go through all of this in terms of that emotional turmoil, torture, frankly, for her. And you're saying that she has to do that so that you can actually then acknowledge the fact that that wasn't the best thing for her. Madness. So, yeah, so we had to follow that route. But the one thing that I had with the Boston Children's Hospital, et cetera, was I had somebody to talk to. I had a really responsive doctor. Norman was amazing. And to be able to talk to somebody, to be able to get that reassurance, to be able to have those questions that come up answered was invaluable, which is why we are really clear that what we do, Anne, is we're here for you. And we won't charge you to talk to a real life person. That's just part of the care that you get. And we want you to feel comfortable and we want you to feel safe.
That's what you're saying there is about, we want your child, Jackie, to go through male puberty to prove that it's the right decision for her. I'm just thinking, as you're saying that, I was thinking, look at all the rhetoric around trans people, i.e. trans women. It's not beating around the bush here, trans women in sport. The current IOC and other regulations, aquatics, you name it, all the rugby, everyone's come out with a rule. Basically, they're saying if you've been through male puberty, or then you're ineligible. So what we're saying is, what we need you to do is you go through your puberty as normal, work out when you get to the age of 15 that it wasn't right, and preclude yourself from ever being a professional sports person in any field, just in case you may be wrong. Whereas puberty blockers could have just given you that little bit of breathing time, let your brain mature a bit. You could take it for a test drive, make sure you're comfortable with it. And then you haven't precluded the rest of your life from that decision, because not doing something isn't a zero-sum game either, is it? It's
not a neutral act. Yeah. To deny access to medication, to deny access to care, is not a neutral act. And in fact, for trans young people, as we know from the reaction of families to the blocker ban, is actually disastrous. And there's blood on West Streeting's hands already. There are young people who are not with us anymore because of what is happening with access to care through the NHS. And it's incredibly sad. Incredibly sad.
And coupled with that, the empowering the anti-trans rhetoric through this as well. So it's not just the action of blocking, it's also the enabling of the rhetoric and green lighting it in the mainstream media, in GPs, in teachers, in people in authority. It's the whole of society is now being green lighted that trans people are bad. Being trans is bad.
Yeah, being trans is bad. A cisgender outcome is a preferred outcome. And that's what comes through so plainly from within the, you know, the CAS review and the other rhetoric that's out there. It's, you know, let's try push for a cisgender outcome. Let's try and push you in a direction that means that you're not trans. And that's conversion therapy. That's conversion practices. And that's what these new centres are doing as well. And we've heard reports from families about the kind of discussions that their kids are being subjected to, which shows that what's been practiced on them is conversion practices. They're basically trying to persuade people that they should be comfortable with their sex assigned at birth, and that, you know, to be trans is a poor outcome, I feel like I'm in a constant state of rage at the moment, and I have to give my head a shake every now and again and sit back and go, right, okay, you're doing everything that you can, you're working alongside people who really believe in this, you know, you're doing what you can when you can, and you're not giving up, so that's all I can do.
Yeah, it is. It is, and I get frustrated that people want everyone to be normal, and whether that's trans people, gay people, bi people, anyone who doesn't fit this kind of biblical version of who you should be. Even the Bible allegedly is 2,000 years old, way before today's society was ever even conceived. So how we can reference things back to these traditional values that were never really in existence anyway. They're just people with power and privilege trying to control the masses through rules.
And again, it's about you know, look over there. Don't look at what I'm doing. Look over there and blame that person over there. Don't blame me with my stack of cash who's basically pushing society in a direction that's really harmful for the majority of its citizens. Look over there and pick on that person there rather than actually paying attention to what I'm doing.
I've got a fair few friends around the world, and I haven't managed to convert any of them to being trans.
You're obviously not working hard enough.
Tried.
Yeah, I mean, I've been told that, you know, I transed my daughter because I didn't want a gay son. And my gay son finds that a little bit odd, but, you know.
I'm a huge fan of a protest singer called Grace Petrie. I was at one of her, I think it was her comedy show, and she stood up at the beginning and said she's really, really frustrated. Why hasn't the trans brigade come for her? Because she's a butch lesbian. She's an out and proud butch lesbian. She's going, I'm an ideal candidate to being converted to be trans. So why isn't anyone trying? Why isn't anyone trying to convert me to be trans?
Where are you?
What's wrong
with
me?
I love her stuff. I love her stuff. She's amazing. And yeah, again, you know, yeah, I've trans my kid. We're transing kids. We're, you know, I mean, what? You know, I couldn't make my kid eat her peas. Never mind make her be trans. I mean, and my gay son is like, well, you clearly didn't try hard enough with me, Mom. So, you know, you didn't do the job right with me. If I did, then I'd have two trans kids, not just one. Bizarre.
I think
bizarre. Yeah.
The other thing that frustrates me is that if I came out as neurodiverse, on the spectrum, ASD, whatever it may be, it'd be, oh, you're neurodiverse, it's fine. But I kind of self-declare myself as having a neurodiversity, which is my gender. It's just my brain thinks differently. But it's the wrong type of neurodiversity. It's not trendy enough for society. But yeah, it's people are making judgments based on lack of knowledge.
Yeah.
Manipulation.
And it's
agendas.
And it's not involved in their life, so I don't know whether or not it's a distraction from their day-to-day that they can pick on, you know, somebody else. Or it's, I mean, somebody said to me the other day, it's not. It's just some people find trans people icky, so they don't like it, so therefore their reaction to it, because they don't understand it and it doesn't affect anybody that they love, their response to it is to push in the opposite direction.
And that's a really good way of describing it, icky. And unfortunately, or fortunately, that's kind of the definition of transphobia, isn't it? It's a fear or this ickiness, a dislike, a distaste for, based on a bias. And
yeah.
that's exactly what it is. And yeah, and I've got people in my life that maybe not use the word icky. They've just described me as not having enough feminine energy for them. And yeah. That's fine. Yeah, whatever.
I mean,
whatever that is.
I mean, oh my, what is that? What is that? I mean, they could say the same about, you know, a large percentage of the cisgender woman population. They might look at me and go, you're not feminine. You haven't got the feminine traits, blah, blah. What a load of absolute bullshit.
Bollocks. Bullshit. Yeah. Bollocks, yeah. You can use those words. Don't worry.
Oh, that's okay then. I'm very sweary normally. I've been really polite.
Yeah. That's okay. Someone normally gets the F word in early, but yeah, we've done all right today. And I think, but isn't that the problem sometimes is if you look at the media representation, when you're trying to talk about trans people having an opinion, it's become activists, lobby groups, protesters, and all the imagery is around young trans people with banners, flags, T-shirts, burning effigies, all this kind of stuff. You talk to people who have a less than trans positive view. They're in suits and ties called professor or doctor or something. So we're trying to paint trans people as anarchists and the people who want to put reason back into society as being the logical, thoughtful, professional side. And that doesn't help. You know, the mainstream media are pumping this imagery at us all the time as well.
All the time. I mean, the number of anti-trans articles are, bearing in mind the size of the population, there's more articles that are painting trans people as, you know, we've talked about this already a little bit, as dangerous, as predatory, as liars, essentially. That there's more of them than there are actually trans people in society. Over the last few years, there are more individual articles that have been published throughout the mainstream media than there are actual trans people, which is unbelievable. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
We've got two each, two articles each. It is.
I mean, I don't know how many have been written about me. And obviously you've been in a similar position with being somebody who's openly out as a trans person. It just, me as a very visible ally and trans adjacent is how I call myself. Yeah, it's insane the amount of attention we get literally just for wanting to support people and to be able to get on and live their lives.
That's all we want to do, get on with our lives. Thank you,
exactly.
Susie.
Exactly. That's it.
Absolutely fantastic. How can people get hold of you? Tell us a bit more about the website, anything else, details?
Yeah, so all of our, I mean, it's really simple. It's like just www.ann.health. And if you go onto our website, it's got the number for the helpline and it's got the web chat link. So you can click on that and you can, you know, you can make contact with a real life person, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. You can email at hello@ann.health. And we've got, you know, a team of amazing people who are either all trans or trans adjacent on the team who really care about the lives of the people that we're supporting. So if you want to get in touch with us, please do. And you will be contacted back by a human being.
So if you're listening to this, it's ann.health.
Yes.
It's not, that .health is one of these newfangled domain names. It's not .health.co.uk. It's just ann.health.
That's it.
Enter.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Susie, it's been an absolute pleasure and thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
It's been lovely to speak to you. And at the same time as like vaguely depressing talking about all this stuff, it's also nice to know that there's like-minded people out there who are fighting for the right things.
Yes, we are. Lots of trans adjacent, lots of trans allies, lots of people out there with lots of love, lots of support in their hearts. And as I keep saying to people, we just got to hold the rope. Hold the rope. Don't need to pull anybody over. Don't need to win. Just hold the rope and the world will keep turning and things will get better.
Yeah, I agree. And just need to keep hoping and supporting each other. And if you see somebody, you know, who's struggling, please reach out.
And sorry, Susie from Ann. Thank you.
Thank you.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.